Thank you. So yes, my name is Mario Turek. I'm at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton, and what I thought would be nice for this type of occasion is to talk about the Milky Way and basically what we're doing here in the program we're having called Building the Milky Way, where the theory is and where the observations are, how the two come together, and what are the challenges for the next 5 or 10 years. So I hope that the title was interesting enough for any X-Files buffs out there. We are moving, as far as the Milky Way is concerned, these surveys that I'm going to talk about are quickly moving us from I want to believe phase into really seeing what's out there. But I'm going to start, since we have an audience here that are not only astronomers, I thought that it would be a good idea to start with just a general overview of not only the Milky Way, but the whole universe and the picture where the Milky Way fits in. So I'm going to take the biblical approach and start with creation. The universe as we understand it today started some 13.7 billion years ago in something we call the Big Bang. The theory that describes all of that, the concordance model, the theory behind it is called Lambda CDM. Lambda stands for cosmological constant, C stands for cold, and DM is dark matter. These two are what basically our universe is made of. So today in the universe we have 70% of this stuff called the cosmological constant that we call lambda, thanks to Einstein, who in his equations introduced it first and named it lambda. We have about 26% of dark matter, which we have no idea what it is. We have suggestions, we have some ideas, but we don't know what it is. And then 4% is us. So everything we see, feel, hear, look at in the universe sits in these 4%. Now this model is relatively simple. It has only 6 parameters. And it manages to describe everything from the Big Bang all the way to galaxy formation. The idea is that, how do you form galaxies as we see them today? The idea is you start with the Big Bang. In the beginning, you have quantum fluctuations that just pop out in vacuum and so forth. We have something called inflation, which from my point of view as an astrophysicist is kind of magic happens, in a magic happens black box. Inflation stretches these quantum fluctuations on large scales, the scales of our universe, and what you're left with after the Big Bang is a hot plasma of matter and dark matter, where you have some fluctuations, some overdensities and underdensities initially in the universe. This is where the universe comes into the phase where we can describe it with our normal laws of physics. And what we think happens...
What time scale is that?
Oh, this is like T equals zero. So this is where I'm going to start. This starts cooling. So these fluctuations, this plasma start, the universe starts expanding, the plasma starts cooling, and the fluctuation starts gravitating towards each other. As they do, they increase their contrast, so you start having things that were the deepest fluctuations here collapsing first. And if you start with something that's 10 to the minus, I don't know, 5 or even more, just fluctuation, they start increasing, and you start forming first stars first, and then first galaxies. And this is something that happens in timescales. If, let's say, for first stars, maybe 50 million years after the Big Bang, and then you get first galaxies relatively early in, let's say, 500 million years or so, even less than that. These things are still fairly uncertain as far as the timescales are concerned. But what we understand, what we know that happens, what we are fairly certain that happens in this paradigm is that small galaxies form first, and then those small galaxies in these overdensities start clumping together, start merging, and start creating larger and larger galaxies. Oh, let me try to do something like a galaxy here. And then these large galaxies then grow by additional mergers with smaller galaxies. Smaller galaxies themselves have grown by smaller mergers. And you have this hierarchical picture of structure in the universe forming, where small stuff forms first, clumps together into, collides together, merges together into bigger galaxies. Bigger galaxies merge into even bigger galaxies. All those galaxies start coming together and merging into groups of galaxies, into galaxy clusters, and so forth. And then we get the universe as we see it today. Question? So this happens, this growth by mergers is something that is inherent in this cosmological paradigm. And this is how we think the Milky Way also was created. So it started with small building blocks that were merged together to form the galaxy. As
the process stopped, right? That is, if you wait 10 billion years, do you expect even larger structures?
The process, that's a good question, because the process stops. We're actually in a fairly interesting time in the history of the universe, which is a concern for physics, because we don't like to be in interesting places. On philosophical grounds, that right now we have this cosmological constant that forms 70% of energy in the universe. And its feature compared to these other things, so these are the baryons, this is us, so this is this is matter that we understand. This is dark matter, this is matter that we don't see, but we kind of feel we understand. It's just like the baryons, it just doesn't interact. This stuff here is just weird. What this does is, instead of gravitating, it repels things. So what happens is, and additionally, as the universe increases, its fraction in the universe becomes larger and larger. So what happens, what's happening today is that the cosmological constant is becoming dominant. So in this hierarchical structure formation, this hierarchical collapse, the collapse is being stopped by the cosmological constant. So whatever structure is formed by now, that's it. No more bigger super, super, super clusters and so forth because of this thing if the universe continues the way it's going right now. Question?
Is it understood how the large spiral arms can form from these random mergers?
The spiral arms are... The details of them are not understood, but what is understood is basically you have a disk-like system. You perturb it somehow, you introduce a wave, a density wave in the system, and you get a spiral arm. So that's kind of the basic mechanism. So the details are not really understood, but they're not actually crucial for all of this picture. The spiral arms are actually something like they let's say decouple nicely from everything I'm going to talk about here. So I'm not actually going to be talking about spiral arms very much. So this is how the Milky Way, this is how we think the Milky Way formed as well. So and the way we study this is using simulations. So this picture here, this stuff here is easy. You can treat it with linear theory, but once you start having galaxies collapsing and things gravitating, you really need to use n-body large numerical simulation. And some of the people we have here in the program are really leaders in the field. For example, the biggest simulation right so far that attempts to simulate a large chunk of the universe, the Millennium Simulation, is Carlos here?
He just left.
Yeah, so we have a couple of people who have worked on that. That simulation shows this structure formation happening. Then, if we want to understand how really the details of the galaxy formation happens, or of galaxy mass, dark matter, what we call halos, then we take just a smaller piece of this large simulation and simulate it with much, much, much higher resolution. So leaders in the field here are, again, Carlos and Jürg Diemand, who's over there. And then if we want to understand how the disk in such form, then we take an even smaller box and we simulate it by adding gas and all of these nasty things that include not just gravity. And we got Chris Brook there and a lot of people here in the program who are doing such things. Now, the result of all those simulations is a prediction. If this is what Lambda CDM is, this is what describes the universe. So this is all we need. So you can make a prediction on what the Milky Way is supposed to look like. So the Milky Way is supposed to have a disk. It's supposed to have a little bulge in the center that's there, that's a remnant of the way it was formed through mergers and so forth. Then, since this structure forms in small clumps that then collide and pile up onto the Milky Way, you still expect to see some remaining around the Milky Way. So you expect to see a lot of satellites around the Milky Way. And when I say a lot of satellites, I really mean a lot of satellites. We're talking about, let's say, 200,000. And then this is us somewhere two-thirds out of the way in the disk of the Milky Way.
200,000 bound, right? Is that the idea?
200,000 bound. Out to, let's say, 100 kiloparsecs. Am I saying this right, Yurik? 100. Oh, and sorry. If I start speaking in funny units, please interrupt me. So 1 kiloparsec, so 1 parsec is 3.26 light years. And a light year is the distance it takes light to travel in 1 year. So the reason why this is defined as such has historical connotations, but basically one parsec is like 3 times a light year. So 100 kiloparsecs is something like 3,000 kilolight years. Sorry, 300 kilolight years, 300,000 light years. So this is what we expect from CDM simulations. Now, contrast that to what we've known. So this picture was pretty much well-formed by, let's say, early 2000s or so. Now, contrast that with the galaxy that we saw at that time. We knew the Milky Way had a disk. If you go out in a clear night, you'll actually see it. Maybe not from Santa Barbara or LA, but if you drive away. So the Milky Way has a disk. It has something that looks fairly small, maybe a bulge or not. We're sitting here. At the time, we knew of about 10 satellites. So there was one, I can't really drive the scale, but the largest one, the Large Magellanic Cloud, is something like 50 kiloparsecs away from the center. There's a small Magellanic Cloud down here. There are a few other galaxies. There's, let's say, Draco up here. Basically an order of 10 of them. Another thing that the simulations predict is these smaller galaxies interact with the Milky Way. So what you expect is some of them will come close to the disk and to the center of the Milky Way, and they'll get tidally disrupted. And what happens when you tidally disrupt a galaxy is you start ripping stars from its core, from its body. So the galaxy starts forming these long tidal tails that are just stars that have been ripped off the galaxy. There's a tail going in front of the galaxy, extending in front of the galaxy, and there's a tail trailing the galaxy. So this is also something we see in simulations. Back in the day, let's say 2000, we knew of one such galaxy that exhibited this kind of behavior. It was, at the time, the closest galaxy to the Milky Way called Sagittarius Dwarf. Coincidentally, it was behind the center of the Milky Way from our point of view. So while we were seeing stars from the Sagittarius Dwarf, basically since there was astronomy, there's a globular cluster here, so a cluster of stars that's named M54 that's associated with Sagittarius Dwarf. And M stands for Messier, who was a French astronomer back in the 19th century. So this was seen for a long, long time. We didn't really understand what it was until recently. this little galaxy sits behind the Milky Way, and what's been seen there is that it seemed to be first elliptical in shape, and seemed to have tidal tails. The Sun is here, as I said, and this distance from us to the center is 8 kiloparsecs. So let's contrast these two pictures. So one is, first thing you note is there are lots of these satellites that we expect, according if Lambda CDM is correct, there are no satellites over here. Second thing is, we do see one thing with streams that up here, we expect to see a lot more of these things with streams here. Then we see a bulge over here, and we don't really see much of a bulge in the Milky Way. So these are
the question, please.
Yeah, sure.
You talk about these tiny dwarf galaxies mm-hmm. that you call satellites roaming around. Now, in some of the textbooks, what is the official distinction between one of these tiny galaxies and a globular cluster? So you're not talking about globular clusters at all, right?
I'm not talking about globular clusters. The distinction would be whether they're dark matter dominated or not. So we believe that globular clusters are really stellar systems with little or no dark matter, while these galaxies, actually what's in the simulation, in these simulations, there are really no stars. What people are tracking here are dark matter. So these are dark matter clumps. These are really dark matter-dominated systems.
So how do we expect to observe them?
We hope, or we think, that they should have stars. And that's going to be one of the conclusions of why we don't see some of these. But for now, at the time, it was thought, you have a dark matter halo, so a clump of dark matter, it has to have some baryonic matter inside. That baryonic matter is going to go down to the center, cool, form stars, and therefore you have some stars. So for each one of these halos, you expect to see at least some stars. You go out, look for them, and all of your sky is supposed to lit up with these small satellite galaxies, and we didn't really see that. Now, these are the problems, and part of the solution, that's one thing that could explain this difference. The second thing is that we didn't actually have the sensitivity to detect all of these small halos until recently. So what happened was, astronomy since the dawn of time had surveys. I think that the first survey was probably Hipparchus, and I'm not talking about the satellite, but about the Greek philosopher, who just looked at stars and noted down where each one of those are. However, if all of the satellites that were known maybe 10 years ago were discovered in these surveys. The way you did surveys, let's say 20 years ago, you didn't have computers. You would take a photographic plate, put it on a telescope, go do a survey, and then look at the plates yourself and try to tell whether there's a galaxy there, whether there's like clumping of stars that might be a galaxy. Or if you had lots of graduate students, they would look at these hundreds of plates that you had to try to figure out where the galaxies are. As you can imagine, that's a fairly inefficient process. This situation has changed just recently when we started putting CCD cameras on telescopes and when we started building large CCD cameras designed to do surveys. So what I'm going to talk about is such a survey that played a large role in bringing these two pictures together and reconciling them. It was called the Sloan Digital Sky Survey. This here is one of the crucial words in the survey, because if we didn't have an automated way to sift through this data and to really look for faint signals in the data, we'd have no way of finding anything that I'm going to talk about. So the SDSS started some 15 years ago now, but it actually started taking data for real in, let's say, 1999 or 2000. Imaged one quarter of the sky. So I'm going to draw it here. If this is the Sun, what Sloan did was take an image in a quarter of the sky up here and then in a smaller region in the south. So they took a census of basically every star that lived there and every star that was down here.
Question. Does the numerical simulation, are these simulations good enough to tell you how many stars are in each dark matter clump?
The simulations, so I glossed over one huge thing that is not included in simulations, which are stars. So the difficulty, so the dark matter is at the same time naughty and nice. It's naughty because we don't see it, but it's nice because its physical properties are extremely simple. It doesn't interact with anything. The only thing that works, it doesn't radiate. The only thing that works with dark matter is gravity. So it's really easy, well, quote unquote, easy to simulate. You just do n-body simulations. However, if you want to include stars, then you have to include gas. When you add gas, you need to worry about hydrodynamics, gas dynamics. You need to worry about radiative transfer, about cooling of gas, about how do stars collapse. And even if we have, let's say we have just like a giant bowl of gas and we want to understand how a single star forms in that bowl of gas, we still can't do that really efficiently. However, the nice thing about dark matter is that it forms maybe 90% of what's in a galaxy. So we can treat, for the largest part, we can treat baryons, so we can treat ordinary matter as just a small perturbation. So we just work with dark matter. And then the results of these simulations just tell us where the dark matter is. And then we assume the baryons have to follow the dark matter. And therefore, the baryons have to, the stars and so forth, have to be in these dark matter clumps. So that's the idea.
Your simulations give supermassive black holes?
That's, again, a question of the baryons. So these specific simulations I'm not talking about do not tell you anything about how supermassive black holes grow, but there are others that try to model that, and they do get formation of massive black holes, but that's, again, a separate issue that's also very much at the forefront of research right now. Okay, so let me move back to Sloan Digital Sky Survey. So what Sloan found, the way Sloan works is it takes images of the sky, and it does that in 5 photometric bands. So basically what you'd optimally want to do is take a spectrum of every single star. If you have its spectrum, you know what its, let's say, surface temperature is, you know what its luminosity is, therefore you know how far it is, but just comparing its intrinsic brightness with how bright it is on the sky. That's expensive. So what Sloan does is takes that spectrum, is instead of taking the whole spectrum, it just takes images in 5 different filters. So stars are, to first order, just black bodies. You have a black body spectrum like this. You take an image in a filter here, and a filter here. You get an integrated flux here and here. And from the difference of these two, you can figure out where the peak is and what the effect of, and what the temperature of the black body is. And therefore, you know what its luminosity is. It basically comes down to that. If you know its luminosity, you know how far it is. We did this with Sloan. The survey's digital, so everything comes down in a database. And we map out where something like 50 to 60 million stars are in the Milky Way. What we do then is take data sets like that. And the first thing to do is just draw maps and see what the Milky Way looks like. So when you do that, one of the first papers that did that was Heidi Newberg. I'm not sure, was she here at the program at any point? Yeah, she was here at the conference. And so when they did that, they discovered something interesting. First, they found this Sagittarius dwarf. They found a signal up here for the stream. Secondly, what they found was another stream that seemed to be close to the plane of the Milky Way. So that was the harbinger of the things to come with the SDSS. Then myself and collaborators did a similar thing. We found 2 more. We found one here, and we found another one sitting here. So like one of these disrupted tidal tails of galaxies. Then a different survey called 2MASS, 2 Micron All Sky Survey, managed to trace the tidal tails of the Sagittarius dwarf around the galaxy. So it actually discovered that there are really long tails of this galaxy, of this small galaxy that are going all the way around. And then finally, what the conclusion of all of this is basically that, yes, we do have galaxies like this that are currently, they're still merging. We have evidence that there's stuff merging with the Milky Way. There are long tails around it, just as one would expect from simulations. And we do see them in the Sloan.
So, could you use Doppler to figure out which way they're moving? Is that consistent with some?
We can. So the idea, the thing to do with these, with the streams is you try to get the rate of velocity at many points. And you also, what you would like to get is proper motion. So to know in which direction they're moving, as you said. But then you don't know what really the potential of the Milky Way is. So then you use this measurements along the orbit to try to constrain what the shape of the potential of the Milky Way is. And the potential of the Milky Way is determined by the dark matter. So what you're investigating with observing these long arms is what the potential of the dark matter is. So the result is that it's approximately spherical, but not entirely, which is also consistent with what you expect with these simulations. But let me move on to something more interesting. So let me just put a tick mark next to these long arms. The even more interesting part came when there was a group at Cambridge that developed a way to look for these faint satellites. Because if you have a faint satellite like that, first of all, what you'd expect is, if you look in the sky, you just see a little small clump of stars that all appear to be at the same distance. So what they did was come up with a technique to sift through this database and to look for clumpings like this. So this is actually one of the first... I have to be careful because if someone did it before, they'll be very angry. But one of the first kind of data mining efforts in a large survey like this in astronomy. And this is interesting because, as I'm going to conclude, this is the direction towards which astronomy is going. So these data mining efforts are becoming more and more important. So what these guys did is look for these clumps automatically. So first they found a few by just eyeballing the images. But then they looked at them automatically together with other groups on this side of the planet and so forth. And in less than, I think, 3 years, the number of satellites and known satellites around the Milky Way essentially doubled. So they found something like 10 more that are very faint, that have been discovered here in the Sloan survey. And remember, this covers only a quarter of the sky. So there are many, many more of these out here in the Milky Way. So we're starting to see something like that. So our picture is getting closer to this, but nowhere near to the number of a few hundred thousand that we expect. However, if you look at the properties of the new satellites that were discovered, there's also something interesting in the individual properties of the satellite. First is, what we can do is, if we know there's a satellite somewhere and it has stars, we can go and measure the velocities of those stars. And then those stars live in what we assume is a dark matter potential. So their velocities, their velocity dispersions are going to reflect how much dark matter there is, how deep the potential is at that position. So what that gives us is, for each star, or for each baryon, how much dark matter is in that galaxy. Now, the typical number for, let's say, the Milky Way disk only, is maybe an order of 1 to 2 in units that we call mass to light ratio, where we divide the mass by the light in units of solar mass and solar luminosity. So for sun, the mass to light ratio is 1, because there's just the sun and it has its own luminosity. If you imagine that there's a sun and then there's as much as dark matter around it that we don't see, then the mass to light ratio would be 2. For the disk of the galaxy, this number is maybe 1 to 2. For the entire galaxy, for the entire Milky Way, this number goes up to, say, 70 or so. for these dwarfs, for some of these dwarfs, this number goes up to around 1,000. So what we see is we start seeing these dwarfs, but they have a lot more dark matter than say our galaxy. And what's the second thing that's interesting is that many of them have approximately the same amount of dark matter, but they differ in how many stars they have. So one of these guys called Segway 1, which was just recently discovered. Segway 1. So it has mass to light ratio of around 1,000. We expect that its mass is maybe an order of, say, 10 to the 6 to 10 to the 7. And observers in the audience, correct me if I'm misquoting numbers, but solar masses. But this is almost all of this is dark matter, because the actual stars that we see are just on order of a few hundred solar luminosity. So the equivalent, the stars that we see there is just as you have a couple hundred suns. So for this object here, it's clear that it's a dark halo. It's very dark matter dominated with very little stars.
Can people characterize the stars in this thing, Seg1? Mm-hmm. Is it all main sequence or other kind of stars?
No, the ones that we see here are mostly red giant stars, but that's just observational bias.
So it's pretty old, no. Is that right?
Yes. So this is not recent star formation.
Jenna? I thought there was just one red giant in Segway 1, and then if another star goes off of the main sequence.
You're right, yeah. this one here is tip of the...
I think it's the turnoff.
The turnoff stars, right. So these are the stars, this is like F dwarfs, so something a bit brighter than our sun.
But if one star in Segway 1 goes off, becomes a giant, mm-hmm. then it's going to overwhelm the luminosity of our system. Right. So it's kind of amazing.
But the nice thing about it is a lot of these satellites seem to have similar masses in dark matter, but have very hugely different luminosities. So then it's relatively easy to imagine that you have some of these satellites that have absolutely to have. Again, about the same mass in dark matter, but have virtually no stars, so that we don't see them. And the reason why that happens is, as you said initially, these simulations here include only dark matter. They do not include baryons. They do not include star formation. What can happen is, if you don't have enough dark matter, that the potential is not deep enough, you have some baryons inside. Then you form your first stars, and then those first stars go supernova. And supernova blows out all the gas out of that really shallow potential, and then you're left with nothing. You cannot form more stars because there's no more gas. The second way to get this is, so the theme is how to get rid of the gas. The second way is there's something in the early universe called reionization. When again, first stars light up, they start ionizing the gas around them, and that gas can be driven out of these small halos and then just leave them as empty dark matter things that are just sitting there. When you include all of those corrections in, combine them with the stuff we discovered with Sloan, what you find out is that this observational picture starts becoming very similar to what we expect from simulations.
Yeah. I realize I'm confused about something. The usual Milky Way dark matter halo, mm-hmm. how far does that extend out on your diagram? Is that including most of these?
Oh, yes. I mean, the dark matter halo, if I try to draw it to scale, I would have to draw it out to 200 kiloparsecs or even farther. So this is 8 kiloparsecs. So this would
these are really clumps all the way inside our own halo.
These are clumps inside our own halo, yeah. So. These are the things that are.
But you think of them as other galaxies which came in, and not just clumpiness that formed around our halo somehow.
Well, we think of them as separate entities because the stars, they're bound. So dark matter that's in these clumps is first bound to the clump, and then the clump as a whole is bound to the Milky Way. So if you ask, What is the
evidence that it was ever outside the halo of the Milky Way and sort of came in, or could they have just sort of formed in the halo?
They form together with the Milky Way halo. Let me say that way. And in this hierarchical picture, then they start piling on the Milky Way, towards the Milky Way. So the ones that we're seeing today are the ones that have formed farther out from where the Milky Way halo, from where the center of our halo is now. So they basically didn't have time to complete that and fall. Okay, so I'm going to slowly start to wind this down, but this is what I wanted to say. These two pictures are starting to get reconciled, and our kind of idea that the Flambecedia model is what describes the universe and specifically what describes the galaxy has been reinforced by the observations of surveys like Sloan in the last couple of years by a fair amount. What there are still things that are unclear. So, for example, one of the problems is while these small satellites that we don't see, so this is what's called the missing satellite problem. While the missing satellite problem has almost gone away, it hasn't gone away completely. So we'd still like to understand the details of the process that drives the gas out of these small clumps and makes them dark to us. Second thing is that may not be the answer. So these small clumps really could, it may happen that they really are not there. Because if you have this cold in cold dark matter model, this cold thing is what makes these clumps appear. If dark matter for any reason is slightly warmer, you can wash out these small fluctuations and therefore get rid of all of these subhalos, all of these satellite galaxies, and we wouldn't be able to see the difference between that model and this one here. And that's important because what you want to understand is what's the nature of dark matter. Even better thing about understanding the nature of dark matter is, and that is, I think, something that in the next couple of years is going to be extremely interesting. These dark halo, these satellite galaxies may contain lots of dark matter. And if dark matter annihilates, we may actually see a signal of that annihilation when you observe it from Earth. So there's a satellite right now in orbit called GLAST, and it was just renamed to Fermi, that looks for gamma rays. And that satellite is going to look for various astrophysical sources of gamma rays, but it's also going to look towards these small dwarf galaxies and towards the center of the Milky Way, where we expect the density of dark matter to be, where we expect dark matter to be the densest. And if you start seeing gamma ray photons coming from these clumps, where we know the satellites are, or if you start seeing gamma ray photons coming from nowhere, that's going to be a huge indication that there's dark matter over there and that it annihilates into something that we observe on Earth. And then I guess the PI of GLAST is going to go and buy himself a tuxedo and tickets to Sweden. The second thing is that these surveys, the survey that I talked about, Sloan, is just one in a series of surveys that are being planned. So in the next 5 years, we'll have at least five or six more of surveys like this that are going to be much better than Sloan, going to cover the entire galaxy, that are going to map the positions of all the stars, the velocities of all the stars, and the chemical content of a fair number of stars in the Milky Way. What we will have is a situation where the gathering of the data is not going to be the problem. The problem is going to be to ask the right questions and to interpret what we're seeing. And one of the things that these huge new data sets that are coming in, and I guess this is similar to what's going on in genomics, where you have huge data sets and then you try to data mine information out of that. One of the things that is going to be interesting to look at is, what's the potential of the Milky Way? So we'll have stars, we'll know how they move. They move in a potential that's dominated by dark matter. Its shape is also something that's predicted by these large simulations. And that's something that we'll be able to find out in the next couple of years. We'll discover all of these streams all the way out to the edge of the halo, essentially have a complete picture of what the galaxy looks like. be able to compare that to what cosmology tells you that's supposed to be there, to what star formation and just astrophysics tells you what's supposed to be there, and basically learn new things about both how galaxies form and how stars and galaxies form, and so forth.
When you drew those two pictures a while ago, beginning of the lecture, you specifically mentioned that in the simulation the bulge is larger than what is observed. Is that a concern?
That's something that's unresolved right now. So what we have is we have disk galaxies that have virtually no bulge. And when we do a simulation of this galaxy, when we collide it, when we merge it with something, it usually creates a bulge. So that's right now a problem because we don't understand what's going on. But the simulations, either some of them do not include gas at all, and those that do make some idealizations about how it behaves. So that may just be a problem of gastrophysics. So when did you have to take what gas does into account to explain away these the existence or non-existence of the bulge. But that is something that's one of the things that we've discussed around, that we discussed here, and that's being worked on. But more or less, that's all what I wanted to say. And I think you should take this away from this picture away. So imagine that it was drawn much nicer from my talk. The Milky Way is not just a disk of stars that are swirling around nicely and that nothing changes and so forth. The Milky Way was created through these mergers with smaller galaxies. The Milky Way still has lots of these small galaxies surrounding it. Some of these galaxies are still merging with the Milky Way. They're small, but they're still there. There are lots of satellites around it. And instead of the Milky Way being a nice and peaceful place where nothing happens and, you know, static, and this is what it was and this is what it'll look like forever, no, this is a snapshot that we're seeing right now of a really dynamical system that has gone through a lot during its evolution. And what it consists of is a disk, but also these smaller things around it, a huge halo of dark matter that forms maybe 90% of the things that are the Milky Way, and all of that is in this large universe that is dominated by that thing called the cosmological constant. So I'm going to stop here and take any questions.
Say a little bit about what the picture looks like on the larger scale of the local group. I mean, expect to find these satellites, for example, everywhere between here and Andromeda.
We see a similar situation around Andromeda. So around Andromeda, we see these tidal disruption events closer to Andromeda, where satellites were disrupted and then shed stars, and we see lots of satellites around Andromeda. What we don't know is, say, there's a satellite halfway between us and Andromeda. There obviously is not a big one, and we don't expect to see a big one. But for these small satellites, there are zero observational constraints. So the newer surveys in the next couple of years are going to be able to answer that question. So what is the distribution of, say, smaller satellites between us and Andromeda? But you can think of Andromeda as just a slightly larger version of the Milky Way. Virtually anything we see, everything we see in the Milky Way, we see over there, and vice versa.
What I'm missing is the scales, which you can easily tell me. The distance between here and Andromeda is...
The distance between here and Andromeda is 760 kiloparsecs.
Or 200,000 parsecs for our, just the satellites. And
for the satellites, we go out... Let me think. Does anyone know what's the one that's most distant? I think they go out to 100 kiloparsecs or so. Do we have anything more than that?
Yeah, I don't think we have anything beyond 100 kiloparsecs. Yeah. But the question is to whether or not the Milky Way's halo and Andromeda's halo are overlapping. I mean, that's a...
Oh, yeah. I mean, we do expect to see that. I mean, we do expect them to overlap because there is no... you know, clear cuts to where the Milky Way halo is, and then there's nothing, and then there's Andromeda. But these two live in the same kind of group where you have the Milky Way halo continuing onto Andromeda's halo, and the boundary is somewhere halfway in between. But that's kind of the level of understanding we have.
Yeah. what fraction of the mass of the halo do you expect to be in these condensed objects?
That's uncertain because it depends on simulations.
Yeah, what does the simulation give you? I'm interested.
Dirk?
Around 10%.
10%, okay. So there's just a big gaseous halo between them?
No, there's almost, well, again, this is kind of difficult because we don't know whether there's no gas, whether there's gas or no or not, but we don't, we don't see any, we don't see huge amounts of gas. So when I say halo, I'm thinking dark matter. Yeah. There is some evidence that there's a gaseous halo around the Milky Way, but it's really hard to tell how far that gas is. Yeah. Okay. Whenever gas is mentioned, then we kind of do this.
No, I really meant the dark. So the dark matter, where's the edge of the rotation curve? So the edge of the actual halo, the edge of the condensations?
For the Milky Way, you don't know that. It's easier to know that for external galaxies. But.
Can you use gravitational lensing to look for these collapsed objects in the halo that are remaining dark?
You can, and it's in a way it's easier to do in external galaxies. So if you have a strong lens, say you're looking at a quasar that's being lensed by an external galaxy, and the image of that quasar is split up into a couple of different lens images, and then what you can look at is what you can calculate is where those images are supposed to be, assuming a smooth halo profile. And then deviations from both the position of the images, the timing of any variations in flux, and the amplitudes of the flux are influenced by small clumpiness in the halo. And it's one of the ways how people are trying to really assess how many dark matter clumps are there in other halos and what their properties are. So. That's an excellent question. Yes?
At one point you mentioned that people doing simulations are adding some warm dark matter to the simulation to check the agreement of the observation and so on. Is this kind of stuff now good enough, or will it ever be, when will it be good enough to tell us something about neutrinos?
I think neutrinos are, it's fairly certain that neutrinos are not the dark matter we're looking
for. I know, but people that add the component.
Oh, I actually know very little about that because it's not really popular at this kind of time, since cold dark matter seems to fit virtually everything we try with it. But there still is this possibility that it's not entirely cold, so that you can wipe out the substructures, the smaller substructures. But for the details, I really wouldn't know how to quantify an answer to your question.
I listened to Carlos's talk, right, and he discussed this issue of the satellites. But it looked to me like in the Millennium simulation, he had a kind of evacuated shell. Maybe my impression is just wrong. There were very few satellites.
Well, most of the satellites, because the satellites that are close to the center of the Milky Way merge into the Milky Way. So I guess what he was saying is that the distribution of these satellites is such that most of them are at the outskirts of the halo. So I think that was it.
Any other questions or comments?
There's one over there.